Hi, my name is Salema Mabena Masakela. I'll say it for you one more time. Salema Mabena Masakela. And you are listening to the What Shapes Us podcast. You are listening to the What Shapes Us podcast. Hello, friends. How are you? How are we across this most interesting globe? Welcome to the What Shapes Us podcast. I am your Uber driver. If you don't like Uber, get out. My name is Salema Mabena Masakela, and I'm happy to have you with us again. Thank you to those of you who have been writing DMs and emails and Twitter notes being like, hey, we see you. What Shapes Us podcast, welcome back. We've missed you. I'm not going to lie. That shit feels good. Feels really good. A lot of you commenting on the Rada Blank episode. Someone said, hey, I felt like I was privy to two friends just sitting on the phone having an open and raw conversation about where their lives stood in the world. Thank you. That felt good to hear. A lot of you were excited about the Mark Rebelay conversation, even though it was a year old, which I thought was really cool. I just loved that his story resonated with so many of you. And how could it not? I mean, in a dark-ass world, a story like Mark's, you know, gives us a little light. Whew, 2022, if it's not one thing, it is another. Just as COVID is like, I think I might take a light chill pill on y'all. Our man. I know. I shouldn't say it like that, lest people get it misconstrued. One Mr. Vladimir Putin has decided, hey, you know what? I'm unhappy with the country adjacent to mine that used to be quote-unquote, a part of mine. I'm unhappy. I want my ball back. So I'm going to invade and go and take what is mine so that my legacy will make me feel like a big, strong man. We're going to war, folks. If you liked COVID, stay for the war. And it's a lot. It's a lot to watch. And it's not to say that, you know, this world is not in a constant state of war somewhere, you know, in and across Southeast Asia, and we know about the Middle East and various conflicts in and around Central America, and, you know, strife in Mexico, so many different places. Our own warlike strife that we have here in these United States of America on these streets every day. People are dying unnecessarily all the time. It's humans. It's what we like to do. I don't like you. I don't like how you live. I don't like who you pray to. You know, I don't like what your people did to my people once. I'm holding a grudge. Let's fight. Let's kill. And on and on and on and on. And so here we are, finding ourselves, watching in real time, because, you know, one of the things about war, it's like sports. It rates. People like to watch. People are curious, right? And so the 24 news cycle just gets excited. Like, yes, war. We're going to give you constant updates on what is going on. And it's if you turn on one of the channels, you know, like I did accidentally, not accidentally, I'm not going to lie, the other night I tuned in. I was on SportsCenter and I was like, oh, let me just shoot on over to one of the major news networks and see what's popping. And there's, you know, someone bravely standing on the balcony of a building, smoke in the background, and they're giving you the play-by-play. Like it's sport. You know, we treat it like it's sport, and, you know, various pundits are going to come on and give you their perspective of what's going to happen, when what's not going to happen. You got the Tucker, I've never been punched in the face, Carlsons of the world telling you why Vladimir Putin is actually not so bad in comparison to what the people and those in America who are looking to rob you of your freedoms. Is he really that bad? He's not telling me that I have to learn about racism or on and on and on and on. I don't know. I shouldn't wade into these waters, but it's ludicrous. I don't recognize, not that any of it was like normal before, but shit is really highly unrecognizable right now in the world. And all I can think about is, you know, the manner in which it's always humans. It's always the human cost. You know, we talk about, you know, the number of folks killed in these various aspects of war or terrorism or anything. And it's numbers. It's a scoreboard, you know? It's a stat line. And it's humans, beings, it's families, it's people having their lives ripped apart. And I don't understand it. I just don't comprehend it. I don't understand it because at the end of the day, every one of us are racing towards the same stop sign. I say it all the time. Every single one of us are racing towards the same stop sign on this journey. How would you like to get there? How would you like to spend it? How do you want others to feel around you? And there's a certain sector of people in this world who are so wrapped up in either demented ego or idealism that they want to spend the rest of their life in a narrative in which they get to dominate other people, either in thought or action or whatever. And I don't understand it. It's fucking exhausting. I think about the people. I think about the people whose lives are upended permanently. And, yeah, it sucks. But then you see, you know, people who spring into action, like the chef Jose Andres, right? Like, a war starts and somehow that dude is like, you know, I was watching some video of him. You know, I think he was in the border of Poland or somewhere on the border of Ukraine. And if you're not familiar with Chef Jose Andres, you should, I mean, check him out. But he's a world-renowned chef. I met him once at a Google conference. I didn't know who he was. I'd heard his name, but I didn't know who he was. And I was sitting next to him at a dinner, and I asked him what he did. And he's like, oh, I'm a cook. I cook. And the next day, that cook was on top of the stage explaining to people how, you know, the first thing that he thinks about when conflict takes place and people are displaced is the dignity of human beings and how that dignity, that self-esteem begins with food, right? This common language, this sense of security that we get from food, from a well-cooked meal that whilst you're chewing and digesting, just for a moment lets you know, I'm okay. And he talked about how psychologically, you know, something is that we take for granted, as simple as food in the midst of catastrophe, and not just like nourishment, but food that tastes and feels and hits you in a way that speaks to your soul, even if it's for a brief moment in the midst of all going wrong, what that does for human beings. And I was blown away by this dude. And I was very lucky that I got to meet him. And you know, I saw him, I was on the Twitter today, and there he is, you know, giving you the landscape of the mobile kitchens as these refugees are making their way across various borders. It was a trip. And it's such a trip, right? Because we're constantly having these huge conversations about, you know, around the world about refugees, right? And the demonization of refugees. And coming from Africa, we've seen what happens when people who are fleeing bad situations try to land on other shores that come from listen, I'm just going to say it straight up, that come from black and brown areas. We are quick to justify how the places where they are from are so uncivilized, and the customs that they are bringing are going to muddy the waters of the places that they're entering, and how those people can't be sustained. Surely not here in the United States, that's for sure, right? But it's very interesting to see the different sentiment and tone and the ability for people in the West to find instant empathy with the people of Ukraine. And listen, I have deep empathy and feeling for the people of Ukraine. But I am struck by how much easier it seems to be for the West to identify. And you hear people on various news programs and reporters saying, hey, you know, these people aren't coming from uncivilized countries like, you know, Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Africa, northern African countries, Central and South America. These people are coming from Europe. These are civilized people. These are people just like us. Aren't all people in this world just like us? We're all just, I got news flash. We are all just like us. But it's so easy to take the familiar lens to justify why some might be more us than the rest. I shan't understand it. And again, at the end of the day, it comes down to the people. To the people whose lives are upended and displaced for interests of those with agendas that have nothing to do with their lives. Today's guest on the What Shapes Us podcast is an old friend of mine by the name of John Rose. John Rose is a former professional surfer. I've known him for about 25 years, and he transitioned from being extremely good-looking and a model and globe-trotting surfer into founding an organization called Waves for Water, with the interest of helping people who are going through natural disasters or suffering from wars with the thing that is most essential to our life, right? We can live a long time without food, but water, yo, water fucks the whole thing up. And he started this organization first, you know, and you'll hear it in our conversation with the idea of like, I'm just gonna, you know, when I go on surf trips, looking for waves in remote areas, I'm gonna bring these water filters to local peoples, teach them how to use them, so you know they can have more opportunity at clean water. And then you'll hear in the conversation there was a very impactful incident that took place when he was in Southeast Asia, when he was on a surf trip, changed his life. He was forced to spring into an action he didn't even know how to perform. He learned and got to find out about himself, has learned a lot about identity. You'll hear him describe, you know, the difference in identity as a professional surfer that's representing a huge surf brand like Quiksilver, and definition of self, and then transitioning into this life of service that feeds a certain part of you, but also leaves you a hole in others and upends a lot of personal life and forces you to look in any direction at mirrors that don't hide the good, the bad, and the ugly of who you are. And I really enjoyed this conversation with John. He's a good man. He's grown a lot over the years and in this service work that he's been doing. This conversation took place a couple of weeks ago. I was speaking to him. He was in Lake Tahoe, where he lives now and operates out of. Me here in Venice. And I hope you enjoy it. I hope that you can marinate in this and maybe find some windows into yourselves. And more than anything, I hope that you guys can remain positive in the midst of constant 24/7 conflict on top of conflict at home and abroad. Take care. Enjoy this conversation with John Rose. John Rose.
Yes.
My guy. It is really, really good to see you, man. When I looking at you at this laptop, the first thing that comes to mind is when we would run into each other in Manhattan.
Oh yeah.
Of all places. At the Paramount Hotel.
It was the whiskey. I think just called the whiskey, right? The bar in the Paramount up by Times Square. So random.
Early 2000s, right? And it was like the Paramount in New York had become like this, the place to stay, and that bar, the whiskey, like very, very cool. And I didn't know that you, I mean, our friendship was based and rooted in surfing, you know?
Of course.
And there, especially during that time in the early 2000s, there just weren't a lot of, there weren't a lot of surfers who, outside of surfing, were curious and exploring and like putting themselves in, actively putting themselves in other circles to get inspiration, you know? So knowing you from surfing, which was cool, but then seeing you in that, I remember, never forget, like that took our friendship in a different direction, being like, oh, okay, this guy, he's out here searching.
Yeah, and you were doing the same thing, you know? And I want to say it was even potentially like 98, 99, 2000, right around there. I mean, because I remember I had a girlfriend in New York at that time from those trips, like that came from that, you know? And I think I had just turned 20 or something. I don't even know if I was like drinking legally. We were just, because New York's just so much fun and we were just getting after it. And yeah, when I remember seeing you, I mean, I remember exactly walking in and you were sitting on like a booth, but there wasn't another booth facing it. It was like the back of a wall. There's a booth. And I remember being like, Salema? What? Like, wait a minute. And you're like, John? Like, oh my God. And then it was like, well, we have to hang out. I mean, obviously we got to hang out for a few days, you know, because we know each other. And it was just like a, you know, that familiarity is so special in rare when you're in new places. And then you get to create new experiences together and have your own context.
Yeah. And we ended up having a lot of adventures in the city together.
Totally. So good. I'll never, ever forget you. I don't know. One night, I think we probably had more drinks than we should. And you were like, you kept saying your name over and over, your full name. You're like, Salema Mabena Mazzichela. Salema Mabena Mazzichela. But then me and Ashley would go home and we would just like say your name over and over. We're winding down the whole thing because it's so pretty. Like, your name's so beautiful from start to finish, the whole thing. And of course, lot of the surf industry didn't even, they thought your name was Sal.
Yeah. You were one of the few people who like actively were like, no, I'm going to call you by your name.
Oh, totally. Well, you told me at that time and you kind of like said the whole thing. And I remember that I was like, God, his parents really thought about that one. It's so beautiful.
Yeah. It was my grandfather's name. My grandfather was Salema. And then,
Mabena, right?
Yeah, there's a clan in my family that are the Mabenas. But when I got from the East Coast where everybody had those kind of names that I was used to, and then to California to Carlsbad, people were just like, "What? So what?" And then so it was very, very easy. Where one day a kid came up to me in school, like a few days in, it's like, "Dude, we got it, bro. You're Sal.
You're Sal, dude. I mean, mine's not nearly on the same level, but still I'm Jonathan. And it happened the same way. I never changed my name to John. It was all the kids in school, like at fifth grade, like when the first day started or something, they're like, John.
John,
you know, it's just easier for us to say or whatever. And then it just stuck. And then you like go along your way in your, you know, professional life and it just stays. And it, you know, Southern California, gotta love it.
Yeah, man. Well, Jonathan Rose, it is nice to see you. We used to run into each other in Venice. Whenever we'd see each other, if one person was walking down the street, the other would pull over and say what up. And we've had some great adventures around the world, but it's just been rad to see where your life has gone in the last 20 years. You know, when I think about you and my earliest memories of you, I think of, you know, this Quicksilver sponsored pro surfer who's living the dream. Probably one of the first people to make it at being a traveler, like a traveling version of a professional surfer without having to do contests. And I just remember you were one of those people who like cracked the code to be like, yeah, y'all can try to kill each other and treat these things as knives, but like, I'm gonna go over here. What drove that for you?
I think it was a lot of it, and I do remember it feeling like very fortunate and being aware of how lucky there was probably like a handful of us. It felt like, at least, you know, whether it's the Malloys and Donovan Frankenreiter, Brennan Margeson, you know, a bunch of guys that really kind of paved the way, a little older than me, but it was still in the beginning of that movement of the professional free surfer. You know, like I was grinding away on the QS, and, you know, Benny Bourgeois was my travel partner and still one of my dearest friends. And I just remember grinding, you know, that word is real, you know, it really, especially back then, you know, it was not the Challenger Series and the Dream Tour. It was like, there was no waiting periods. So you knew when you were surfing at the Newquay Cornwall Classic in England on September 27th in 6 months, your heat was going to be that day.
Right.
You knew exactly. So like you show up and it's windy and onshore and high tide and it's just lapping on the beach and you don't even get a wave. And then the next day is like pretty decent. There's a swell comes in, you know, and you're just like, I was totally living the dream and still having the time of my life. And really, I look at that whole time period as like teaching me so many world lessons and life lessons. Cause we were really like let loose as late teens and into early 20s at that time period in pro surfing. If you were doing the tour, we were like unchaperoned wild things, you know, like, just let loose on the world with good paychecks and no rules. Like I always say in pro surfing, there's like the guys before us, they had no rules, but no money. And then we had this sweet spot where there was no rules, but money. And then it goes further and there's more money, but rules.
Right.
So we had this like really cool middle ground. And I think it was so valuable to be a part of that. And, but I guess going probably 5 years of that, I'd say 17 to 22 ish. And, you know, I didn't qualify, but, you know, I had some good results and it was fun, but it was more just like the lifestyle that I loved. And then I went to Quicksilver and said, hey, I think I'm going to go to college or something. Like I don't really want to do the QS anymore. And I just, you know, I'm not the best guy. Like I obviously didn't make it to the CT, but I just want to let you guys know. And and that year I happened to get a cover shot, where was it? Padang Padang,
in Indonesia.
Chris Van Lennep, fisheye shot from, you see the cliff in the background and stuff. And Quicksilver just said, because of that movement of those other guys I mentioned, because of this kind of surge of the free surfer, they said, well, actually just go do that, get more of those photos. And I got a raise. And then I, and then I went on to having probably arguably the more successful part of my career, the next 6 years or 7 years, you know, as a free surfer, and really getting to get more creative and, like you said, travel and explore. And of course, you know, you had your agenda, like you had to get, you know, exposure and stuff like that. But yeah, it was a cool arc.
I remember at a certain point there used to be, and that cover, was that a surfing or a surfer?
Surfing
magazine. Yeah. Surfing magazine cover. I mean, and in those days, getting the cover of either was, you know, boom.
Huge.
That was the equivalent of a million likes on Instagram.
Yeah.
You were an influencer.
In the sense that people hold it and look at it all month, and actually months after, like, yeah, you get a million likes on something and then they're just swiped gone.
Right. Even more than that. It was an NFT of sorts.
Yeah. Kind of. Yeah. I guess so.
It was highly, highly valuable. You couldn't be reduplicated. The magazines would get passed along to someone else, and it had a very, very long brand life from a marketing standpoint, if you got that. I remember at a certain point that there used to be a meter, an exposure meter that the magazines would do, of like what pro surfers getting the most exposure. And Jonathan Rose was killing the exposure meter.
Totally. Well, what's cool is like that's a measurability. You can quantify your value. Because you're not doing contests, so you're not placing, right? Mm. But that was one way. As kind of like goofy and cheesy as that was, it was like one way to say, like, well, actually, proof's in the pudding. Like that, I should be re-signed.
Yeah. You know? Would you rather me lose a shitty contest in England on a gray day, or keep getting this brand exposure without having to do any of that bullshit?
Yeah, totally. And of course, it had its own. I mean, the whole surf industry has its own, you know, sets of bullshit. Not just on the contest scene, on the other side too. Just dealing with, dealing with different brands, and of course, just egos, your own included. it was all such a good stepping stone and platform for really doing anything else in life, because you got to learn a lot of things, like. You learn hard truths. You get your ego beat a lot, but you also have, you know, these surges of accolade as well. It's a cool, I think it toughens you up a little bit.
Mm. I want to go back a bit and sort of discover where your love for the ocean and your love for water came from as a kid.
Yeah, man. I was born in Colorado, and my dad was a ski instructor and carpenter. My mom, you know, was kind of, they're both hippies. And then we moved to Southern California from there, because my dad had grown up in the South Bay, actually, in Los Angeles. And he grew up surfing back, you know, balsa wood boards and stuff, surfing the cove over there. And I think he just felt like, I want my son to experience the beach. And so we were at the beach for a couple of years, and then he got called by some buddies who he knew from the Rockies, and they were opening up that Mount Shasta ski park. and said, hey, would you like to run the ski school? So we moved to Mount Shasta. This is like all before I'm 10 years old. And I love Mount Shasta. I mean, that's what's not weird about me living in Truckee now, because I really do have some mountain roots. And then my parents got divorced, and you know, it's interesting. So that I was around 10, and it's interesting. Lately I've been really diving into, you know, mental health as a whole, in terms of a topic, but also just my own relationship to trauma. And specifically like a lot of the traumas that I've endured as a first responder. But the first trauma when you're a kid is if your parents get divorced. That's arguably probably the first real trauma you go through. I look back and it was like pretty good. Like it didn't seem that huge. It was a bummer, but my dad's whole sort of philosophy, I ended up going with my dad, and he was like, we were in Mount Shasta and we literally like drove away in a two-wheel drive pickup truck. And we went to, I think he took me out of fourth grade. I had like 2 months left of school, and I don't think he told anybody. I mean, I'm sure he told people so that the authorities didn't think he kidnapped me type thing, but it was just sort of like, we're out, you know, and that split was hard. And my mom knew we were going, but we basically drove from Mount Shasta down the length of California and then into Baja, and then went for 3 weeks going through Baja. I mean, he had a surfboard in the back. He had a bike, you know, camping stove. We camped all the way down Baja and then got to Cabo. This is before all those big hotels and everything are there. Camping.
What year?
This is 88. So, I was 10 years old. I was born in 78. So, it was, you know, we're at Cabo. I remember vividly being on the beach where there's now huge hotels, but like we just camped on the sand. He'd set up his surfboard, put the camp stove on the surfboard. So it was like a kitchen table, you know, cook food. And we lived very minimally and did this whole adventure there. And then he bribed our way onto a ferry, and we went over to Puerto Vallarta because he had like some expat buddy who had land in what is now Sayulita, but at that time was just like a tiny little village. And we'd have to go to locals' houses and say, hey, can you make quesadillas for us tonight? But I surfed for the first time there on his 6'4" bright pink Stussy surfboard. And that was when, so I'm really highlighting this story because it really defined my life. So it was a 4 month trip. It was a month of the last month of school year plus 3 months of summer. And we were bushwhacking through jungle. I surfed, you know, I fell in love with surfing for sure. But what I realize now as an adult is that my entire life has been based around adventure. And of course, because I was 10 years old and my dad took me on the most rad adventure. And also it's tied to hardship and trauma. So if anything is ever hard in my life, I go cure it with adventure. And I've talked to therapists before about that a little bit, dug into that. And you know, and some are like, well, that's not always the best approach, but at the same time, like if it works, it works. You know what I mean? Type thing. And obviously you can unpack that for a while, but the reality is like, I'm getting a lot of clarity now around like not just the choices that you make early on in your life, but the choices that are made for you that, cause you don't have the choice. How much that informs and defines your life. And in my case, I'm very lucky. Like my dad made some really dynamic choices. And it must've been really hard for him, to be honest, at that time. But it really set me up to look at life through a different lens. And we came back, you know, it was like almost school year was starting like late August, and he just enrolled. We went to Laguna Beach and he just enrolled me in fifth grade.
After your 4 month, basically like deep dive into this culture in the rawest form. And now you move to Laguna Beach that happens to be like within the epicenter of the whole culture of not just surfing, but also professional surfing.
Yeah. And I think that, and you would probably find this with a lot of professional athletes, but I think most of them probably did have some hardship or something in, and their sport was their escape. Now I'm not saying I had this like crazy hard life, but you know, we didn't have a lot of money. We had, you know, we were living in a tiny studio in Laguna. My dad slept on the bed. I slept on the couch in the same room, but we were blocked from the beach. Mm. So that was his choice. Like, hey, and he told me at 10 years old, he said, hey, it's your choice. We can live here, but we sleep in the same room, or we can move to the next town inland and you can have your own room. Because it's that's the amount of money. Like, you get this over here, you get this here. Of course, I chose the beach, and it really, I'm not saying, like, I don't feel like I was a sad kid or mad or angry. I had a lot of support, a lot of love. I still had a good relationship and had a good relationship with my mother. I just didn't see her as much. I felt so loved and cared for by my dad, but it's any trauma maybe that I was feeling from that, you know, family breaking up, I just funneled into surfing and adventure, like new experiences, new exciting things, and surfing, and you just dive head into it. And then you know, the rest, I guess, becomes history.
That makes a lot of sense, man. You know, I'm 7 years older than you, but I started surfing the same year in 1988 because my family moved from the East Coast to Carlsbad in the North County of San Diego. My dad was on the East Coast. I had a bit of a strenuous relationship with my stepfather. And when we moved out here, we didn't have anything. My stepfather was day laboring on construction sites as he was trying to figure out what he was doing, what we were doing. And I remember that first time that I stood up on a wave, felt this thing and this ability to leave all of it behind and be scared and excited at the same time and always have new possibility whenever I paddled out, that like, all right, this is my thing. Like, this is the place that I'm always going to be able to run to. And at that time, I didn't even realize that that would give me access to the world in a different way. But it did make it so that, yeah, like, it's funny when you say that thing about, like, when shit going bad or whatever, like, this choosing adventure, I never realized until I hear you explain that. I'm like, oh, I know that. like, I can get on a plane and, like, go and try and find some new possibility in this thing, and it gives me a sense of buoyancy. And for a long time, I don't know about you, but like, I didn't feel comfortable, quote unquote, being at home long. You know, yeah. Like, any sense of once the normalcy would start to sit in, like of being in routine and being home and seeing my other friends sort of very patterned, controlled lives and family and jobs, et cetera, I'd be like, I have to go. I need to, like, please, I need to go. Either a job or a trip or something, I got to go. And yeah, that helped me run from my shit for a long time.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's very addictive. And it's definite, there's such a fine line between escapism and truly using it as a healing modality, because it can be used as a healer. If in my, like, the way I view it now is, looking at like seeking adventure or any of that stuff, if there's something hard going on, as really using it as a pattern interrupt.
Mm.
So if you're in this funky pattern, then interrupt that pattern, but don't get lost in it and escape, like still face the music on this side and use this as like a little way to shake the tree and get yourself out of that pattern. So I think it's really nuanced. And if you're not really actively self-aware around it, then it does become escapism. And it really was escapism for me forever, because it fucking worked.
Yeah. Which makes me begs the question for me, when the professional surfing world is such that, like, you're killing it until you're not the youngest, coolest kid in town. The ability is changing, right? There's some new kids who are coming up and they're pushing the level and they become more attractive to sponsors, etc. You make a decision, like, am I going to get pushed out of this thing or am I going to quit? You had, what, like a 13, 14-year run on this?
Yeah, it was about 13 years, yeah.
As a professional surfer. And then you stop. Mm-hmm. I wonder, like, what was it like sort of coming to grips at that point with identity, you know, with who you were now that, like, the cover to magazines and this lifestyle. And I'm also, like, you were also were being tapped by mainstream companies to model and things like that because of your ferocious good looks. What's it like to sort of find yourself in that, like, you identity wise, like, oh, okay, like,
it's so
tour is over.
Yeah, it's so funny that you asked that. I mean, I literally had this conversation like 2 days ago about that very time period. And it's such a reality check. And I was such a realist. I still am in the sense that, like, I was aware enough to know, like, I wasn't living in a state of delusion. You know, I knew the writing was on the wall. I could see it. I could read it. That being said, the surf world is kind of the gravy train a little bit, if you want it to be. Like, yeah, maybe you're making less and maybe you're not the hot or the it guy anymore, but, like, you want to milk it and live a pretty decent life, you can. I just, not that guy. Like, I just never have been that guy. I am probably harder on myself than others. I don't know, in that way. I'm just kind of like, I ain't milking it, and that was awesome, and I'll go do something else. That's cool until you realize that your whole identity is wrapped into this idea of being a pro surfer. And it really felt that way at that time. And it felt so, and I really feel for my ex-wife, because I was married at that time. And, I surely wasn't fun to be around. And there was probably a one and a half year period of time where I was just, like, trying to figure out who I was really beneath everything. And ultimately coming out the other end, realizing that Jonathan Rose is Jonathan Rose, and anything else I do is just an enhancement of that and not the other way around. And of course, it's taking me a lot to come to that conclusion, but that's true for everybody. And it's so nuanced, though, and so interesting when you are so wrapped, especially with careers that you start in your teens, because you are still growing. So you're so wrapped in that identity and you have a full blown identity crisis. And if I didn't have a decent head on my shoulders and like good support crew of friends and stuff like that, I mean, I've seen so many of my peers. I saw so many of my peers at that time just crash and burn. And I had low points, really, really deep low points. But I was able to still weather that time period, you know, and then of course springboard into Waves for Water.
Yeah, I call it the who I am versus what I do.
Yeah.
But when your image, like what people see, who you are, is the fuel of what you do. It is very, very easy to lose the plot and think that they are the same person and the same thing. I went through it radically, especially, you know, during my E! Entertainment years, when suddenly with the X Games and then having you know, a nightly primetime show that where Ryan Seacrest is your lead in, you're suddenly exposed in a way that you never have been before.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was crazy to have that audience and then also be like the host of the X Games. Suddenly you're like walking down the street and people are like, hey, and
totally.
That shit feels good. But I remember when it started, like it got to the point where I didn't recognize myself. I remember the first time that I got like really, really scared of like, oh, like who's that? Who's that? Like looking in the mirror at 4 a.m. someplace, you know, getting into all sorts of shit and being like, yo, who's that?
It's so interesting. This is really interesting to me because even at this point in my life, I've recently come up with this kind of internal mantra that being a kook is the fountain of youth. I'm serious. Like this is like
that's
such
great.
Yeah, that's like been my thing because I moved to the mountains and I have basically started all these sports that I've like really never done before, and I'm that guy now. Like I'm the beginner, and I'm used to being good at something, but realizing that if I can just get past the ego part and the insecurity, that it is so much fun. Because you're back at the early stages of learning curves, which are huge. So you have these huge breakthroughs all the time. I'm 43 years old and it's like having firsts all the time that I'm like, oh, being a kook is literally the secret, is the fountain of youth. And so,
yeah.
But the flip side of that, which I realized recently was so interesting, is that like, I can say that to you right now, but it's because I'm a kook at those things that I don't care.
Yeah.
As soon as you get good, then you start caring. So like if I go surfing, I'm still aware if I'm like performing, if I'm one of the best guys out in the water, I'm, you know, still at this point. Like, so it's not this perfectly evolved, you know, way of living. And I just had this realization a couple days ago. I was like, oh, wow, you're kind of even tricking yourself, dude. Like you're saying this and you're walking this talk over here about like being a beginner and all this stuff, but you still have a lot of ego over here. and that's okay. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just really interesting to like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
It is. When I left E, when I got out of the entertainment business from that like night, that primetime show Gossip World, which I knew like, yo, I cannot occupy this. This can't be the definition of me. The first thing I did, I went to UCB, Upright Citizen Brigade, improv. And
wow.
my friend Hal Rudnick, who I'd met, who was doing some work at Fuel TV at the time, I just was always blown away by this guy's timing. And he told me he did improv. I was like, that sounds cool. And he told me that he turned out he taught at UCB. And anyway, I went and decided to go and take this class. And it ended up being the biggest gift ever because like what you said, like just kook. Like it like Skywalker in the first lessons where he's hanging out with Yoda and he thinks that because he can turn a lightsaber on, you know, he has and the force is in him and he's just flailing. And I was flailing all over the place. And then I had to like literally take my ego, take this like, I'm known in places. I have some level of fame. I'm used to being in front of a camera. And that shit just had to like be so far out of the door to be bare and open and have this team play and learn the rules of operations where like the key to improv is that you're not the star.
Yeah.
The story is the star. And unless everyone's playing by the same rules to advance this story forward, the second you try to look like you're the shit, you fuck up the whole thing and everybody's looking at you like, thanks, asshole. And it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me at that time to find something to just be such a whole beginner at that took me off of my that this pedestal and this, like, coming back to this idea of like identity and that, like, you know, who you are and like what you do, those are two separate things. And you've got to, if you don't hardline that, it's always going to fuck you, which I guess to my next question, as you mentioned, you know, this period that you went through, which retirement from being pro surfer, finding identity, a divorce, which I remember was, you were going through it. I remember our conversations of you just trying to come to grips with who you are and you're working through guilt and all these things. And then, you know, this idea of Waves for Water comes to pass. Where did that come from?
Yeah. I mean, it was twist of fate, really. I mean, the idea itself, inception, comes from my dad. So he was still a carpenter in Laguna. But he saw some article, I think, on the New York Times about the water crisis in Africa, somewhere in Africa. I can't remember where, but just some cover story type thing that got his attention. And I call him like a master solutionist. You know, he's like just an expert problem solver. Mm. And so I think he was inspired by that article, just like, wait, why are they walking 5 miles to the nearest watering hole? Like, why don't they just catch rain? And he saved up money and went over there. And this is
what part of Africa?
It was Kenya, where he originally started. I don't know where the article was about, but yeah. I know he started in Kenya. He started this little nonprofit called Raincatcher. I was still a pro surfer at the time, so this was prior to Waves for Water and all that, and even that dark period. I was still kind of thriving as a pro surfer when he did this. So, but him doing it put it on my radar, and it really, like, it was always there. And I didn't really have any passion around it, to be honest. I just was like, good on you, Dad. That's sick. That's awesome. You know, and just really loved and supported him in that. And so he would save money and go to Africa. And then when I went through that whole, like, down period, identity crisis, I was doing some photography. You know, I was actually starting to make a little bit of money doing photography. I was helping out a buddy, I think both of ours, you know, John Whitledge from Travada, mm-hmm. With like some visual marketing stuff and just trying things out. I mean, I had only ever had that one job. And then I realized, like, you know what, I want to do something. I'd like to go and really selfishly motivated. I'd like to go back to Indonesia twice a year to surf. It was so genuine in its intention, in its intent to help. But it was also not supposed to be a full-time job. It was just like, wait, you know what? The water crisis, out of all the issues and challenges that the world faces, the water crisis, to a non-expert like me, seems solvable. And so that was compared to, like, you know, finding cures for cancer and all this, you know, there's just other issues that were like speaking Chinese for me. Whereas the water crisis, my dad had a little bit of experience in it. And I have seen the need with my own eyes during my surf career, and it just all started to click. And I said, yeah, and also had like a decent base within the surf community that I knew I could rally. And I'm like, I'll just make this little pet project idea. It's not going to be my job. I'm going to be a photographer. I'm going to do this. But I want to be able to go to Indo, this place I love so much. I want to go there a couple times a year. I want to surf and I want to help these places I've been to and call it a day. And so I did that. I had the name, the idea. I wasn't going to do the rain catchment stuff as much, though we do that now a lot. But at that point, it was more just like, there's technology that exists and there's people who need it, but those two things don't know each other. So, and I'm pretty good at like traversing the world. So what if I'm the bridge? What if I bring that technology and implement that technology to the places it's needed and connect those dots? That was a total initial inception of it. I bought 10 filters with my own money, and then went on a surf trip to Indonesia.
And when you got there,
what's that?
They said, and when you got there,
when I got there, well, I had been there actually for a bit on the trip. And then when I was going to go to the other island that I had planned to go help, because I had contacts and stuff over there, we got slammed by that big earthquake that hit Padang, which is the capital city of Sumatra, and also, as you know, the thoroughfare for a lot of those boat trips. And it was like, you know, Armageddon. You know, it was like a total collapse of that place. And it's a big city. You know, there's three or 400,000 people, at least at that time, in that city, and a lot of death and destruction. And I just sort of became the first responder by accident, because that's what I meant by twist of fate. Because I was there and I had these assets on me. And when I clicked into that mode and started implementing those filters purely based off of common sense, because I certainly didn't have experience, I learned so much about myself and certain skills that I had that I didn't know that I had. And just because you're really put to the test, like the veil has been lifted, and you're either going to like sink or swim, so to speak, or you're, you know, like it's going to be very clear in that dynamic of a setting what you're made of. And no matter what, none of it's bad. It's not that you're made of bad and, or over here, you're made of something good. It's just, you're going to know for sure what you're made of and how you operate. And there's no gray area. So going in and being that type of first responder and seeing how much those filters, like they helped thousands of people.
Those 10 filters.
And it's also because it was such an extreme situation that they helped more people, like that there was such a greater need. But at the end of the day, it was like, I got chewed up and spit out of this experience, a completely different man. And it was laser beams of focus coming out of my eyes. Like I was so clear. That whole identity crisis, that whole, everything gone, everything was gone. I just knew exactly what I was doing. I knew exactly my truth. I knew exactly who I was standing in my two feet. I mean, I like came home, got divorced, like, you know, I just made these very punctual, definitive decisions. Yeah. And that was it. You know, it was just like, and I've really never looked back, to be honest.
I remember our first conversation about it, where after you had come home from Padang, you know, which was a crazy story. I mean, you were on a boat when the earthquake happened. If you'd been on land, who knows if we would even be having this conversation. The hotel that you were going to stay in Padang was destroyed. Mm-hmm. Get off the boat into this thing, and you spring into action. But I remember the key part from those conversations was learning how to interact with local culture and being in this, realizing like, oh, I'm people come here and try to take over, go to these places that are dealing with situations and problems and try to take over and essentially be saviors. And I remember the key part of the conversation that we had was like, people are doing it wrong. They don't get on the ground and learn how a local culture works and engage and figure out who within that community puts things into motion so that these things can become an active part of their local culture. And I remember when you explained Waves for Water to me as not trying to be this like savior group, but giving access to a thing and then coming in with humility to interact with that culture and then work with them to see how they would implement it based upon how their local culture works.
Yeah.
And yeah, that to me was just like, huh, that makes such perfect sense.
Yeah. And I mean, that is the cornerstone of Waves for Water. It is, and it always will be. It is just the ethos. It's the everything that we are, is that mentality and that philosophy. Because And it really comes from my surf days, to be honest. Like, because when you're in some like far off the beaten path place, and you're trying to get to this wave that you found on Google Earth or whatever, you know, and you got to like traverse through a community, and you're coming in hot. Like, no, you don't come in hot. Like, you come in and learn and observe, and because you have an agenda, right? Like, you want to get that on that rancher's land, you know, because that wave's over there. I know it's silly using the surf reference, but it's kind of the same, you know, like the more the success of any of our Waves for Water programs is dependent on how well we are as observers, you know, as coming into a community with the term is soft posture. So you come in with soft posture. It's a military term because you can come in like with riot gear, which is hard posture, or you can come in civilian clothing, but still know you're the badass that can like do anything if shit hits the fan. But you can get so much more intel. You can get so much further going the soft posture route in most cases. Sometimes it does take hard posturing if there's a freaking, you know, like missiles coming at you. So that's where those comparisons land. And for us, it's always about that soft posturing and really listening and really being observers and going in and going, look, you guys are the experts here, but you're missing a few tools in your toolbox. And we're gonna provide those tools and all the knowledge and expertise around those tools and technology and sort of skills. And then you're gonna lead. And that is still to this day, it is that is true development work. And more people are, I think, adopting that. I think there's so much transparency now, especially with like social media and everything like that. Like you get called out pretty quick if you come in trying to dictate things.
Yeah. If you smell like you're on some savior shit, hey everyone, look what I did to save these poor people. Ugh. You world's going to let you know.
Yeah. The world will let you know. And even moreover, you're not going to make any progress in that place.
No.
So it depends on what you're intended.
What would you say would be the sort of the identifiable lesson that you learned from carrying that humility and walking into a place that you're not from and listening? I mean, you've spent almost 2 years in Haiti, in the wake of that earthquake in 2010, going back and forth. Not to mention all the other places that you've been around the world through South America, Indonesia, et cetera.
Yeah, I think it's really tuning in your character judgment skills. I think is like the biggest, if somebody asked me what my biggest sort of strength is, it's probably that at this point. Like being able to walk into a room and really quickly identify who's who and what's what. And that's just truly from like, that is a skill, learning how to read people and read your immediate environment. And for me, I learned that skill because it's essential to the success of my agenda. And I do have an agenda. It's access to clean water. It's a very clear agenda, but I'm not going to overpower. You got to know when to come in and like how to ebb and flow with the ever changing environment around you. And that,
and listen.
And really follow the, follow your gut in that way. Like I've been in a place where I'm looking for my Liberia, actually in West Africa, where I was looking for like my next guy, like my community advocate, my guy. He's going to be my guy for a long time, guy or gal, but in this case it was a guy. And on paper, if you were to follow the textbook, it would be like, okay, the school teacher, the shop owner, the pastor, you find the community leaders first, and I did all that. And it just wasn't flying. Like I just didn't find it. And next thing I know, I'm just observing and I'm seeing this kid. He's like 18 years old. And I'm watching this kid interact with 15 people in a matter of 5 minutes on this like one block stretch of dirt road. And watching the way, not just how he's interacting with people, but watching how they all respond to him. From other kids to elderly people to the shop owner to everyone. And they all responded with this, like, not just it wasn't like admiration. It was almost just like this juicy, good energy. Like they were always like, he brought that out of everybody that he was interacting with, and he didn't even know I was watching him. And I went and talked to him, and he became our guy. And he's 18 years old. I mean, he didn't even really have a job. He was helping out at an orphanage because he had no parents. He was helping out, but he also did it because he could sleep there too. But he wasn't just straight one of the orphans that live there, you know, because he's so charismatic and dynamic and all these things. And that's where you realize, like, there's the textbook and you can follow that and it's good to know. But then there is just that mojo and magic, and you got to be able to be truly like have enough humility to listen and go, no, that's it.
There's so much like regular application to real life.
Totally.
that can be made from that.
Well, I mean, there's that quote. It's ironic that I'm saying this because I'm on a podcast right now talking a lot, but there's that quote.
I'm asking you questions.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. You're good.
But I think John Wayne said it, but it was like talk low, talk slow, and don't say too much. And you know, there's something to be said about, and really the way I interpret that is just observe, right? Observe, and then when you do speak, make it count. Have it be just in the sense of it being thoughtful.
Yeah. You talked about that identity fight within this discovery of self as a pro surfer, as you made that transition. What are the challenges in this new identity that you've had for a bit over a decade now? I mean, whenever I see, you know, an article about you, et cetera, I mean, it puts you up on this. It's a lot different now, where it's this by default pedestalizing of you and what you do. I mean, I remember when I saw you on the cover Outside Magazine, I was in an airport and I walked by and I was like, yo, my boy. But then I also was like, ooh, this must come with a lot.
Yeah, you're right. It does. And it's that part of that addiction that we talked about, you know, I guess if I back up to the experience in Indonesia and then shortly thereafter going to Haiti, thought I was going to be there for 2 weeks, stayed for 2 years. I didn't give a crap about anything else in the world except for that present moment only. I was so in my totally protected truth. Like I just was, you know, of course I was also like leaving a marriage. I was changing careers. So it was all so much of a timing thing, but like I got to experience what that feels like. There was no social media, or maybe there was social media. But like it was just starting kind of thing. I mean, in terms of Instagram, there was no, I was exactly where I was supposed to be, and I knew it, and I felt it in every core and fiber of my being. And that's such a rad feeling. That is such a purposeful feeling. And then it became an organization, and then you're managing multiple projects, and then it's the pedestal thing. Like at that point in time, people were like, dude, that's so rad, you're in Haiti, but I didn't even hear it. Like I didn't even respond to the texts, I don't think, of people telling me what I was doing was great. It didn't matter. That's not why I was there. It was such a pure path, and still is. But to your point, and it's a really important one, is like this then turned into my next surfing career. You know, I'm super honest about that. And there's addiction around that too. You know, and it's like really, you got to really be conscious of doing work on the side to make sure that, and I say you, I mean me.
Us, we.
us, we, yeah. But I mean, I'm speaking really about myself in that way, because there have been times in the last 10 years where I've gotten lost a little bit in that whirlwind of the same type of addictive behavior that I had when I was a pro surfer. And then you know, you can kind of come to and recognize. And of course, I'm older now and I have more experience, so I am more inclined to like snap to, you know, easier. But it's a tricky one, and I really have done a lot of work. It's interesting though, because and so funny, because people will be like, "Oh, it's so rad you found your calling," and it's like, "Well, I did. I mean, I found one of them. Like, I love this. This has been, I like that experience I told you about in early days of Haiti. Like, that is the flow state. That is the, and to have experienced flow state in multiple disciplines already in my life is like such a gift. It's so cool, but I want to experience it more in other stuff too, you know?
Yeah. Flow state in your relationships.
Yeah.
Flow state and learning how to be at home. And life outside of the adventure as your savior.
Absolutely. And it's so funny because you said something earlier about routine, and I used to be self-admittedly allergic to routine. Like, you know, just I hear that word and I'd have like hives come, you know, happen, you know, like routine. Oh God, it's so boring and lame. And I'm totally going to butcher the quote. I think it was Michael Phelps or something like that was saying something. He has a really great quote about routine, basically about how liberating routine is and like how freeing routine is. And I was like, wait, what? And I had to unpack that for a bit, but now I am fully of that mindset. Like routine is super freeing, and being free, like out there, you know, traversing the world and always being gone and adventuring / escaping is not freeing. That actually feels like a little bit more of chains, you know, and like I'm bound to this addiction versus being in a routine at home and being able to rely on something and count on it and then see the improvement and the results. And like, yeah, it's really interesting.
I love hearing that I get the sense that you're in the growth mindset for the long haul.
Totally.
And it's easy sometimes when you come to certain, not even epiphanies, but like you get to the base camp of a next level of a base camp in this journey, and you can sometimes confuse it for the summit. And then you know you're feeling all proud of yourself, and then you look up and you're like, oh, there is more to go. And I think, for me in my own life, when you and I are similar in that we've gotten to do and pursue our passions and find out the full capabilities of what of get a glimpse of what that is. But it's also like stopping to appreciate that this is where I'm at, but also like to look up and look around and be like, oh, there is so much more possibility, and attaining that possibility requires more work. It requires getting dirt under the nails to like to grow and learn how to do this better in a way that is of not just service to everyone else, but service to your damn self, like honest service to yourself.
Yeah, so important. And it's such a, I watched you guys on Natural Selection the other day talk all that mental health bit that you guys did. And so cool that you guys brought that up. And everyone has their own versions of you know, these blockages or these challenges that they have in their life. And I think one of the biggest lessons for me recently, and it's been an ongoing lesson in my life. I saw a couple like healers early on. I don't know if you remember Kent Ewing.
Of course.
Yeah, okay. Like, I mean, I saw him when I was in my early 20s.
Throw the elbow in your stomach.
Throw the elbow in. He said something to me one time that was so amazing. He's like, "What's the best feeling in the world, John?" And I'm like a 20-foot barrel. You know, he's like, "Well, I'm in one right now." And I'm like, "No, you're not. You're not, because you haven't been in one and you don't know that." And you know what I mean? Like, I was like, "I appreciate what you're saying, but you're not in one. We're not, you can only be in one when you're out there." And he's like, actually the feeling you get in your body from being inside of a 20-foot barrel is inside of you. It's already there. The 20-foot barrel is the trigger that releases the endorphins and dopamine and all the stuff, right? So he's like, yeah, he's like, "I'm in it right now because that thing's already in me and I can access that." And I was just like, bow, bow, bow. Like, my brain totally melted and exploded for, you know, weeks. I was thinking about that. And then I don't know if I was advanced enough to like really start applying and implementing that, but I still remember him saying that. And then fast forward to, you know, this chapter of my life, I really have come to this conclusion that, like, and it's a daily practice, but like, happiness is not conditional. And for so long as a professional athlete, even in my Waves for Water chapter, I always hinged my happiness on X condition, right? So like, as a pro surfer, if I get a cover, I'll be happy. If I win this contest, I'll be happy. If I get this, I'll be happy. In Waves for Water, it's like, if we get that partner, I'll be happier. If we're able to do that project, if I can just push a little further over there, I'll be happy. What's that doing? That's depriving yourself of this God-given happiness that already lives inside of you. And you're just putting this like lid on it. And then why? You like let it out if this thing happens. And so really working on that a lot and trying to be, I mean, the way you work on it is by being aware that you're doing it. And then realizing like, no, I'm fucking happy. Like I am naturally, organically happy and grateful to be here. And if those things happen, it just enhances that. And so that's like the big, as I said, it's work in progress always, but that's a big one, dude. If we can do that, it's a totally different life experience.
Bang. That's powerful. God, whenever I get a random DM from Kent telling me that he's still alive, I always feel super seen. I'm like, oh, that's great. That's powerful.
20-foot barrel.
20-foot barrel. I'm in one right now. Hands behind my back.
Yeah.
You go from being a poster boy selling shorts so that you can feel your habit surfing with Quiksilver, great years, shout out to Bob McKnight, and you find yourself now needing brands to partner with Waves for Water that embody what Waves for Water is about so that you can continue to move this thing forward. And it's a different relationship, right? When you're just like, who's going to put clothes on my back that are cool enough for me to like do my thing? How does those choices get made now for you, because there is so much more responsibility in what Waves for Water is and how much it affects globally. And you know, it's been really cool to see what you've been able to do in this partnership with Dockers as a result. Like an unlikely place, maybe on the surface.
Yeah, you know, it really is all about authenticity. And like you said, even if it's unlikely, but like unlikely is because, like, by saying that, that's because we have this like preconceived idea of what likely is. And so for me and you coming from the surf industry, basically anything outside the surf industry is unlikely. But that's not true. You know, like that's actually right. not true. Especially in the context of Waves for Water, but it's, I'm still of the same mind. I mean, I still have to check myself a lot and be like, oh yeah, Dockers is like, oh, well, that's more random, you know? But then you realize like the people who work there and there's all these connections and they're owned by, you know, they're, you know, in San Francisco and it's part of Levi's and Co. And it's got these
and also the roots. The roots of it, like with the more you get under the underbelly of totally. California, et cetera.
California cool and the roots of it. And, you know, like I said, the people who work there is the most important thing for me. And so when I'm having these conversations at the early stage, it's really about like I'm kind of doing a little bit of a checklist in my mind, you know, checking certain boxes. Like they just there has to be a certain standard. For me, and it's not that if people don't meet that they're bad or wrong, it just it's not gonna fit for me, you know.
Yeah.
And meeting with Dockers, you know, it's really important to me when people walk the talk because everybody talks, but very early on I was shown from the team over there at Dockers like that they were not only gonna walk their talk and do what they say they were going to do, they're going to do more. And they have, and, you know, we've done five projects last year. So Mexico, COVID was a challenge. So we had to do places that we could have access to, but we did, I mean, I did Liberia, West Africa in the peak of the pandemic, you know, we repaired all these broken down wells and it was just, I mean, we're just doing good work, you know, and they've been so supportive in that. And, you know, we did Haiti after the recent earthquake there, and it's so cool to be aligned with, because in my opinion, brands are they have multiple purposes in a sense. I guess the first purpose for the people who own it is like return, right? Money, I guess. Right. They make these products, and then now those products go out there, but. The secondary purpose, especially if they're aware of it, which Dockers is using the brand as a platform right. to leverage the brand for the greater good.
Yeah.
And they've done that and they do it with flying colors. And it's like, you know, it was really cool. I got to do a collection with them too, which was really fun.
I think you commented because I was rocking your pants.
Yeah.
When they sent me the pants, I was like, these are the most amazing pants. And then I looked in the, and I was like, these are John Rose pants. And like, I've never even seen this camo print before. Of course, this is what John's doing with them.
Yeah. Yeah. So cool. That stuff. I saw you wearing them on the Natural Selection. I was like, yes, that's awesome. I had a couple of people text me who were like, because they got some of the pants too. And they were like, I think Salema's wearing your pants. I'm like, hell yeah. It's so cool that stuff like that. I mean, that's just like icing on the cake, the real action that they've taken just around our programming and stuff like that. And just being in full support and, you know, truly, like I said, walking the talk. And that is imperative for me at this point.
That's awesome. I'm stoked for you. I'm stoked that it's a multi-year deal in which like they really didn't just decide to be on some like, oh, he'll be cool for a season, but that it's this real exchange.
Yeah, and as you know, I mean that happens so often. You know, the flash in the pan type marketing, it's bandwagoners. You know, like
yeah,
everyone jumps on this one because it's like the thing to do, and then it's the next thing, and you're like, but all these people still need help. Like, I don't understand. Like, wait,
yeah,
it doesn't line up. So.
Where do you see Waves for Water 20 years from now? You know, I think there's still something like 700 million people on this planet that don't have readily easy access to clean water, which, you know, if I go to the market down the street at Whole Foods and I see the abundance of people who've tricked the world into thinking that, you know, the water that's in their plastic bottle is more expensive or pH balanced or any of the shit that capitalism allows for when it comes to a natural resource like water. Damn, I just went on a tangent there. Where do you see, where would you like to see this operation 20 years from now?
Yeah, I mean, I think about this a lot, and I think that ultimately, as a founder, you are always, the end goal is that you create something that lives well beyond you, right? Like you kind of work yourself out of the equation at some point. If you do your job well, then you do. You know, you build these teams that that go on and do it way better than you ever could have yourself. And I'm already seeing that. So we have we're a registered NGO in 6 countries, and we have permanent teams in those countries, and they're doing incredible work. Waves for Water Philippines, for example, is, and they just had Typhoon Odette over there. That was massive, like third biggest storm ever recorded in history. And they are smashing it. I have not had one hand in anything, and they're just doing such a good job. I mean, actually to the point where I kind of pride myself on being a disaster relief and response expert. Mm. And I think, led by Jenica, who is our country director over there, she is incredible. But I think they are rewriting the playbook.
And for how it can be done globally.
For how it can be done globally, or just the new standard for Waves for Water, and how, and of course, if other people follow that, then great. But like,
right.
That's growth. That is truly it. And so 20 years, I mean, maybe there's not 6, but there's 20 countries, and they're all feeding off each other, doing really dynamic work, furthering the work, progressing everything off the platform that I founded. And that's sort of that was my role.
Right.
And so that's but sort of,
you're not dictating that. Like the thing has taken a life of its own in its respective places.
Yeah. And that's already starting to happen, which is really cool.
That's awesome. I'm immensely proud of you, man. I'm immensely proud of the journey, the choice of growth. That's choice. It's a heavy choice. It's so much easier to just sit in your old ways and be like, well, this is me. But the choice of growth and being able to get excited about the new outcomes that come from new choices.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. And the feeling's so mutual. I watch you, you know, in from afar, I guess, when I'm on the road and in some far off land, and I'll see something with you, and you know, I got a lot of admiration for you as a person and a friend, and what you've done as well. And you're so good at communicating. And I think it's such a gift, and more, you know, I wish we had more people that could communicate like you do. And it really lifts all of us up, dude. So.
Oh, that's very, very humbling, man. It's a constant learning, you know. My last stop before I came in for this podcast was sitting with my therapist. I drove here straight from therapy, you know, and it's
awesome.
It's about doing that in internal work, and for me, like, not being afraid of my voice, you know, because it's not always convenient what it is I have to say, based in my experiences, and being okay with that, you know. I'm enjoying it, and like you said, man, I hope that true and honest communication, without winning being the outcome, can become something that can define our future as a society. Because right now, it's shit is interesting. Last question.
Yeah.
What would 8-year-old Jonathan Rose have to say to 43-year-old Jonathan Rose?
Geez. I mean, the 8-year-old was so competitive. So Eight-year-old Jonathan Rose would have told, what I would like the story to be is 8-year-old Jonathan Rose would tell 43-year-old Jonathan Rose to remember to have fun. But 8-year-old Jonathan Rose wouldn't have said that. He would have just said, win. So I've come a long way, I guess.
And listen, man, like, you're winning. Winning, yeah, also means something. It means something different. You know, totally. Like you're sitting in you've chosen to live in Truckee and Tahoe and to be excited about new beginnings and all these things that you've described in growth of personally and professionally. That shit sounds like 8-year-old you would high five and be like, yeah, I like how you're winning.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, I love the 8-year-old, like that fire, that competitive fire and spirit is still, it's healthy too.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. The winning, I do feel like that. You know, I'm looking around at the life I've created thus far, and it's a good one.
It's awesome. Let's make some snowboard turns together. No one has to twist my arm to come to Tahoe. And so when I'm yeah, up there, I'll shoot you a line, and also like let's wiggle some waves. Maybe I'll come on a journey with you to do some of the work and get some of the wave reward as well, man. I still haven't gotten to come on a trip with you, so
let's do that. Well, this is our year, dude. This is our year. Mark my words. Yeah, we'll get a good. We'll get some wiggling in. We'll get some waves for water stuff in. And
I've been talking to dockers about finding a way that we can intersect as ambassadors and create some content together that supports what we're both doing.
They've talked about Haiti, which I think that's my vote.
You know, I have such a deep connection to the South African end of my roots. But I've, you know, the other half of me is Haitian, and I stood at the border in the Dominican Republic at Massacre, but I've never been inside the country, and I've always wanted to go back and especially since my grandmother passed away a few years ago, I know that she's just out there going like, oh. You better go and set your feet there, boy.
Yeah. Well, I got the crew there. I mean, it'll change your life. I mean, I took.
Yeah.
Anyways, we'll discuss that. But
yeah, let's see what we can see.
Right on, brother.
Well, yeah, man. Fucking fantastic. I've been looking forward to this for weeks, and it did not disappoint in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and more importantly, just we get to carve out a little time to catch up, and I appreciate it.
It takes a village to bring you the What Shapes Us podcast. Our incredible graphic design team at Parsons Branding. Music by the one and only Hugh Masekela and my band, Alakazam. It is edited by Ernesto Hurtado and Will Broughton. Produced by yours truly, Salema Mabena Masekela, and directed by Ernesto Hurtado, aka Machete, and myself, Salema Masekela. The What Shapes Us podcast is a Rebel Talk Network production.